This podcast is an unedited excerpt from an MCLE program presented at MCLE's Conference Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Please note that MCLE's products, services, and communications are offered solely as an aid to developing and maintaining professional competence. The statements in this recording may not apply to your circumstances, and no legal, tax, accounting, or other professional advice is being rendered by MCLE or its speakers. For full terms and conditions, please see the MCLE website.
First segment that we're going to do is just looking at case law updates. What's been happening in 2021 in particular. Monica Shaw was kind enough to work on this with me, and she's going to talk about what's happening at the Supreme Court, what's happening at the federal level, and I'm going to talk about what's been happening here more locally with the Supreme Judicial Court. Monica, do you want to start and talk about the federal stuff, and then I'll jump in and talk about the SJC?
Sure, happy to start now.
All right, perfect.
Well, thank you so much, Lori, for that great introduction, and to MCLE for hosting this conference. Even though it's a beautiful day, and since it's virtual, you can kick back maybe outside for part of the conference with your laptop. So on the Supreme Court and federal front, there has actually not been a significant number of employment cases this term. And so I want to kind of go back to the end of last term, which may not have been covered at the last summer symposium, and start there. So I'm going to pull up my, I'm going to attempt to screen share. Bear with me. What I want to start with is the end of last Supreme Court's term. There were two major employment cases decided at the end of the last term, and those two cases had a different court, a different Supreme Court. Justice Ginsburg was on the court at that time before her death, and so I think it's worth looking at those cases. And you know, the fact that this term is light on employment cases, you know, maybe for some of us, you know, we breathe a sigh of relief on that front, because there haven't been significant discrimination cases taken on at this point. But I think it's worth kind of looking at what happened at the end of last term and what could be in the pipeline in future terms, looking at circuit case law as well. Starting with the big case that was decided, Bostock v. Clayton County. It's the Title VII case that was decided at the end of the last term, 6-3 decision, and the court through opinion by Gorsuch ruled that the prohibition on employment discrimination on the basis of sex under Title VII extends to discrimination on the basis of homosexuality and transgender status. And Gorsuch's reading with the majority of the court was really based on a textual reading of Title VII. He concluded in the majority decision that homosexuality and transgender status are inextricably bound up with sex, and as long as sex is one cause of an adverse action against an employee, liability is triggered even if there are other reasons behind the employer's decision. And obviously this was a momentous case, but the details of the reasoning matter, and they matter to us now because of the way that Bostock is being relied on by the courts. The textual reading really relied on Title VII's language, which bars discrimination against any individual because of such individual's race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. The example that they gave in that decision was about, you know, an employer terminating a female employee because she has a wife while not penalizing a male employee for having a wife. So it was a decision made on the basis of the sex of the employee. And we'll see when we talk about First Circuit cases that are pending right now, how this language is being used by our lower courts in other contexts, like associational discrimination contexts. But the key point is this extended Title VII law considerably. It gave clarity around the issue of whether LGBT status, is it protected status or not? And so it was momentous in that way. And it made clear, based on this decision, that just because at the time of the law's passage, this was not a class that, you know, maybe the legislature anticipated protecting, now the law reads the way it does read, and it's critical to ensure that that it's read broadly to ensure the protection of LGBT individuals as well as just, you know, male and female gender designations. So I thought this was obviously a great decision, but as we'll see down the road, it's being relied upon in different ways by our lower courts. The second decision that was decided at the end of last year's term is with the case Our Lady of Guadalupe School versus Morrissey Beru. And that case was, again, a Title VII. It was a case that involved employment discrimination and Title VII, and it was a case involving the ministerial exception in the context of religious employers. And I think there was also a disability case as well. So it's, but it was all about whether the ministerial exception applied in the case of teachers who may not actually be designated as ministers themselves, but whose employers believe that they had a religious role in the school. And in this case, Justice Alito wrote the decision, and in that decision, it was emphasized that the First Amendment bars government interference with the rights of churches and religious institutions related to their faith and doctrine, and that includes the selection of individuals who play certain key roles, including and namely religious roles. And the court emphasized that, you know, what an employee is called, whether they're called a minister or some other religious designation, is not dispositive, but it's what an employee does. And the key point is that the court relied on what the school's view of the teacher's responsibilities were, and in determining that these, the teacher had a role that that did involve religion versus simply teaching, you know, formal education that's not religious. And so this really did extend the ministerial exception under federal law. The dissent in this case, written by Justice Sotomayor, expressed real concern that employees of religious institutions could be fired for any reason, even if they primarily taught secular subjects. And didn't have religious titles or training, and weren't even, you know, weren't the religion that the school was. And so the dissent expressed concern about the implications of this decision and how it could extend to many staff at religious institutions. And the question is, and what I've taken a look at is, has this arisen? Is enough time passed since this decision for us to see the ministerial exception being invoked? And I, you know, anecdotally, you know, I've heard of cases, and they may be percolating through state agencies and EEOC. I'm not seeing as many cases right now in court that are invoking this exception for the extended staff members that are kind of listed by the dissent here. But I think that those are likely coming. The pandemic may have delayed a little bit of this of this litigation, and, you know, so we'll see what happens in the future in terms of this. And there's also, Lori will probably touch on, a state case that was decided by the SJC that also involved a ministerial exception. So I think this is going to be an important area that we'll be considering down the road as well. So that was the end of last term. This term, there are, again, there are not a whole lot of cases. One case I wanted to focus on was actually a Title VII case involving a racially hostile work environment in which cert was recently denied. It was denied just a week or two ago. It's the case Collier v. Dallas County Hospital District. And this case got a lot of press when cert was, the petition for cert was filed. It related to the issue of whether an employee's exposure to racial epithets including the N-word in the workplace, was sufficiently severe to raise a disputed issue of fact regarding whether or not that person was experiencing a hostile work environment. And specifically, this employee would walk into the elevator and see a racial epithet on the elevator, complained about it. He would walk down the hallway and see graffiti that had swastika symbols in it and would complain about it. And his employer would not do anything about it. And in fact, when some of this stuff was removed, it was actually removed in kind of a unprofessional manner. So he thinks that one of his colleagues actually just, you know, couldn't stand it anymore and tried to wipe away the offensive language. So this employee dealt with these racial epithets and also alleged that he's a Black employee and he was called boy by a nurse. The Fifth Circuit, as you can see here in the language of their decision, even though they thought it was disturbing, they did not think that the two instances of racial graffiti and being called a boy were sufficient to establish a hostile work environment. And they recognized in their decision that other circuits may disagree. They went through other examples of, other case law in other circuits. The Fifth Circuit highlighted, though, all of its own case law, which I did not cut and paste here, but it's worth looking at because it was quite quite overwhelming to read the types of cases that circuit has determined do not constitute even a triable issue of fact to go to a jury on this issue. So a lot of amici wrote in to try to get the court to review this. And actually there have been decisions in the circuits by both Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Coney Barrett on these issues, on reaching opposite conclusions. And the court decided not to hear this case. So we're still going to be seeing cases like this come up without clear-cut Supreme Court guidance on what constitutes a triable issue of fact on this particular issue, which I just think is fascinating given the climate we're in right now, with the Black Lives Matter movement and where we are on all of that. The next case that I thought was also interesting, and I'll just briefly touch on it, is the Supreme Court has heard a case about the student athletes and NCAA. It's not totally employment related in the traditional sense, but it's very interesting. It's a question of whether the NCAA's prohibition on compensation for college athletes violates federal antitrust law. And basically the NCAA restricts non-cash education-related benefits for student athletes so that they can be considered amateur athletes. And students sued, saying this violates antitrust provisions. And so there's been decisions percolating in the district court and the Ninth Circuit. When this went before the Supreme Court, that even the conservative justices expressed concern that the NCAA was exploiting student workers. And it's quite interesting to read the oral argument transcript on this. The language that Justice Kavanaugh used really suggests that they care that student athletes are being used as unpaid labor for schools and for the NCAA. And I think this is going to be very interesting to see what happens in this decision. It hasn't been issued yet. But in terms of particularly what's, how this can follow and apply to in terms of just the reasoning of the justices on, for example, the NLRA type cases related to graduate students and whether they are considered employees or not. They are now will have the right to unionize post the Biden administration taking over and the NLRA not pursuing rulemaking there. And I think we may see some more graduate student cases come out of the employment context in coming years. So I thought this was an interesting case to highlight. I'll just quickly talk about First Circuit cases, just because there weren't too many Supreme Court cases this term. There is a First Circuit disability case, Bell v. O'Reilly Auto Enterprises, That was decided by the First Circuit, and a cert petition was filed on recently on March 5th. And the issue in that case is whether it was error for the jury or for the, to instruct the jury that a disabled employee to make out a failure to accommodate claim must demonstrate that he needed the accommodation in order to perform the essential functions of his job. And in this particular case, the accommodation requested was to work fewer hours. He was working almost 100 hours a week, and it was to work fewer hours. But the plaintiff himself could, he said he could work more hours and was willing to work more than the limited hours. And so the employer said, well, he didn't demonstrate that he actually needed the accommodation at all. And so, you know, I think that it's an interesting question about what the appropriate instruction is here. The judge gave a jury instruction indicating that a disabled employee is entitled to an accommodation only if he needs that accommodation in order to perform the essential functions of the job. And the First Circuit's holding is that the judge erred in getting that instruction. And essentially, a plaintiff can state a claim for failure to accommodate, even if he can adequately perform his duties without the accommodation. And so I think this will be interesting. We'll see if the Supreme Court takes it up. The next decision is a First Circuit decision on the FCA, False Claims Act. And just quickly, this is a question about what the standard of causation is for retaliation claims under the False Claims Act. And I don't necessarily need to get into the facts, but it was an undecided issue of law. And the court ultimately concluded that it's a but-for standard of causation to prove the adverse employment action in that case, not a substantial motivating factor. And then lastly, there's a few race discrimination cases that I wanted to focus on and highlight. And I think it's just helpful to highlight it given the Supreme Court's decision not to hear or to deny cert on Collier. So we had a First Circuit case involving race discrimination called Alston v. Town of Brookline that was pending in the First Circuit. There were several cases. This one was specifically against the Town of Brookline, and the facts related to a Black man and a former firefighter for the town. And, you know, he had experienced racial slurs and ultimately was terminated after a series of incidents and filed a discrimination claim against a number of entities, including the town. And the court dismissed a number of claims, but ultimately concluded that the district court abused its discretion by excluding the decision and findings of the Massachusetts Civil Service Commission, which had found in favor of the plaintiff in that case. And the court concluded that there was sufficient evidence in the record based on that and other evidence that would allow the jury to conclude that that there was sufficient evidence of pretext. So summary judgment was not proper. And this came under Section 1983 specifically. So the discrimination and retaliation claims were therefore reinstated and sent back to the district court. And then the last case I want to highlight is a pending case in the First Circuit. And this goes back to the Bostock issue that I had highlighted. It's a case called Frith v. Whole Foods Market. And in this case, this case involves a class of Whole Foods employees who demonstrated their support for the Black Lives Matters movement and also for their fellow Black employees at Whole Foods by wearing facial masks during COVID-19 and other attire with Black Lives Matters messaging on it. And Whole Foods disciplined these employees and otherwise had other adverse actions against them by kind of implementing its clothing requirements and dress code requirements. And the allegations in the complaint are that they didn't do so in an equitable way, that they hadn't enforced these dress code requirements previously or weren't doing so consistently. And so, you know, the question was, you know, did this state of violation of Title VII either under discrimination or retaliation? The defendant to dismiss the complaint, and through a district court decision by Judge Burroughs on the discrimination claim, she dismissed the claim, citing Bostock and the textual focus on the protected characteristics of the individual employee, because these were employees who were advocating on behalf of Black employees. They were not themselves alleged to be of a protected class. And so there's a decision there that really kind of narrows associational discrimination claims. And also she determined, aside from one employee who was terminated after filing an EEOC complaint, that none of the employees had retaliation claims. Again, this was, you know, a reading of Title VII's retaliation claims or clauses that could be considered quite narrow. And so this case is now before the First Circuit. I think it will be a really interesting decision once the circuit reviews it and decides it, because I think there's a real question here about whether these plaintiffs were engaging in oppositional activity, and also whether there's an associational discrimination claim that can be made under Title VII or not. So that's generally, I think, the update from the federal courts, the circuit, and the Supreme Court over the last year. Lori, I hand it over to you.
Great. Thanks, Monica. That's really helpful. So turning now to the state and what's been going on with the SJC, before we start talking about the cases, I wanted to point out that sadly, we lost Chief Justice Gantz last year. He passed away, and may he rest in peace. We now have a new Chief Justice. We have Kimberly Budd, and she's the first African-American female to hold that office, so that's noteworthy. And then the SJC has been very busy in dealing with some practical things that don't involve the case law, because they've been dealing with a lot of the court operations and the practical struggles we've been having as attorneys in the pandemic. So if you haven't been following this, it would be good to go to their website and follow all the orders they've been issuing related to COVID-19, the pandemic, court operations, remote depositions, all that kind of stuff, just really practical stuff, and, you know, just keeping abreast of that. I am going to attempt to share my PowerPoint, so let's see how I do. And this is about the actual cases that we've been seeing. Last year, there was a few really noteworthy cases that came out. They've been talked about in a lot, I think. So I've been focusing more on what's just been happening really recently in 2021. There isn't a ton, but there is some stuff that I think is very important and interesting. The first one that I wanted to talk about is the Dewese Boyd versus Gordon College case. This case is pretty fascinating to me as a civil rights attorney because it gets into conflicting rights. We have freedom of religion, and we also have protections for people at work so that they're not discriminated against because of a protected characteristic such as their gender or their support for gay and lesbian people. So here, we heard earlier about from Monica about this ministerial exception. And this is something that's being discussed at the federal level at the United States Supreme Court. So the SJC had a chance to look at that as well. And it's interesting to see how they kind of went about approaching that. So first of all, you know, for those of us who may not deal with this type of stuff, what is the ministerial exception? And this is, it comes up as an affirmative defense. It's available to religious institutions, and it can completely bar a claim of employment discrimination. So it becomes not a matter of whether you did discriminate against someone or not, but you just can't even bring the claim because it's a claim against a religious institution. But it has to be something that's brought by one of its ministers. So then that begs the question, who's a minister? And the SJC heavily relied on what the way that the United States Supreme Court has been looking at this. And there's two cases I put into my PowerPoint that they really focused a lot on. And one of them is Our Lady of Guadalupe, and that's the case that Monica was telling us about that just came out last year. These are the kind of factors that were considered. Job title, job duties, not job duties on paper, but also job duties in practice. You know, religious training, religious role. Those are kind of the main factors that I saw the court really looking at. And put really simply, kind of just focusing on, you know, what did she actually do at work and what did she not do at work? So here we're dealing with a private liberal arts college, and it's Christian based, but it's a college. And so this individual was employed as a teaching faculty, taught social work, did not teach religion at all, was not someone who was ordained, had not been required as a term or condition of employment to do any sort of education or professional development or any sort of education around what you would think of as kind of a what a minister would be doing, those types of religious practices. As part of her job, she didn't preach. She didn't do Bible studies. She didn't do prayer. She didn't take the students to chapel. And the SJC came down saying that she wasn't, you know, looking at all of this stuff, was not a minister. And so because of that, she was protected from discrimination during her employment. So again, her allegations were about, she was saying that she was discriminated against because of her gender and because of her association with individuals who identified as part of the gay and lesbian community. So the affirmative defense that the college had was dismissed and was not allowed to proceed. And very just simply, they looked at really like the core of her job, and they really saw her as a professor of social work, and she also taught related subjects, but they saw her that was the core of her job. This is not somebody who's going to be considered a minister for these purposes. Another case that I thought was interesting is getting into consumer protection in the workplace. So I always think of Chapter 93A as being the consumer protection law. It's supposed to protect people in their, not at work, but in their private life from what's considered to be an unfair or deceptive business practice. And it's something that I don't really think about coming up in the workplace. And typically it's not something that is a claim that's available in the workplace. But the SJC took kind of a fresh look at that in this case, which is Governo Law Firm versus Bergeron. Okay, so since a lot of us don't deal with Chapter 93A, I just kind of put part of it in here just to kind of remind us what it's about. And again, this is a claim that's available based on unfair or deceptive business practices. In here, the workplace conduct was some of the attorneys at the law firm downloaded, removed, and uploaded to a different computer information belonging to the law firm. It didn't belong to them, but belonged to the law firm. This was like research, databases, really an extensive like research files, I guess, of like of everything. I think this was asbestos litigation. Employee handbook forms, files, all kinds of stuff that would, you know, would really help you run a law firm and do the work that was necessary to do. Then they took that and competed with the law firm. So the even though Chapter 93A doesn't normally apply to workplace disputes, here it did, because what happened is they took it out of the workplace and brought it into the marketplace. So the idea is that there's supposed to be some sort of marketplace transaction to have a Chapter 93A claim apply. So here the marketplace transaction was once they took it out of the workplace and started actually using it and competing with it, this was something that that could be a Chapter 93A violation. So kind of the general takeaway is that an employee who misappropriates proprietary materials from the employer can actually be committing a violation of the consumer protection law. You know, why is that significant? It's significant because the consumer protection law has pretty severe penalties. You can get compensatory damages. You can also get double or treble damages. And also you can get your attorney's fees reimbursed. So it's a pretty, pretty significant claim to have. But again, the focus here was on getting this out into the marketplace and having a marketplace transaction. So while it provides some additional protection for employers, which is probably of comfort during these times where a lot of people are working remotely and there's kind of enhanced concern about confidential information and trade secrets and proprietary information, it does provide additional protection. But I would also say not to get overly excited about it or think that it applies every time somebody copies a file. It has to go beyond just taking the material. It has to really go into the marketplace and become something that is, you know, what they're calling a marketplace transaction. So this is another case that we saw. So this is a case that we saw in the First Circuit. Monica talks about this, but this is kind of a different part of it. So this is the part that was at the SJC. She was talking about the part that was at the First Circuit. And this is Brookline versus Alston. So in Brookline versus Alston, we're dealing with the civil service law. And the issue before the court for this part of the case was really for civil service purposes, can you consider things like discrimination, harassment, retaliation, or is that just something that comes up under Chapter 151B? And the way that the SJC looked at it, they said, this is something that can be considered. If you're trying to decide if a termination was made without just cause, you can look at things like racist, retaliatory acts. So what's coming next? There's a couple of things that are kind of on my radar that I think are unusual and interesting issues. One is this case, Osborne Trussell versus Children's Hospital Corporation. So we don't have a decision in this case quite yet, but it has been already heard at oral argument, and that happened in January. So it should be coming somewhat soon, I would think. And so this gets into people who are victims of abusive behavior. So you're looking at people who are domestic violence victims. You're looking at people who are being stalked. You look at a broad range of kind of abusive behaviors, and how do we deal with that in the workplace? So there was that law that came out a couple of years back to try to provide more protections for people who are going through these types of situations, and that law tells us employers have to provide a leave. Employers, you know, can't fire somebody because they've told their employer that they were attacked by their husband and that they have to go to the hospital. If you need to meet with the police, if you have to meet with the DA, you have to go to court. Like these are, you can't fire somebody for that when they're trying to get themselves out of an abusive situation, right? So that was kind of a big deal when that law came out. And now we're seeing, does that law apply to a situation before somebody really starts working? So in this case, there had been an offer of employment, but the person hadn't, my understanding, the person hadn't actually started to work yet. And so does that law apply to somebody who's either a job applicant or who's somebody who's just, who's maybe accepted an offer, but just hasn't actually started yet? Like when does that law start to get triggered? And what obligations does the employer have? So that's kind of the big issue here. So here, this was kind of an initial discussion with human resources. And my understanding is that the employer retracted the offer after finding out about this person who had been a victim of stalking and was trying to seek to enforce some sort of a restraining order. Or I guess it was called a harassment prevention order. So how far does that law actually reach? And are we really doing enough to help people who are in these kind of situations and also protecting the employer's interests and helping the employer understand what their obligations really are? So that should be very interesting to see how Chapter 149, Section 52E is interpreted, and we'll have to keep an eye out for that. And one other case I just wanted to bring to your attention is Mean versus Medical Information Technology, Inc. And this is very recent. So this is a case where an application for further appellate review was just accepted, I think, last week. So this is going to be a while before, you know, we see how this all comes out. Why I think this case is interesting is it deals with the personnel records law, which isn't necessarily a super exciting subject, except it gets at, you know, are you allowed to submit as an employee a rebuttal to a performance improvement plan without jeopardizing your employment? That seems like a no-brainer to me, but the appeals court didn't see this as rising to the level of an unlawful act. So basically the appeals court found the other way. So this gets into these claims where you have wrongful termination and violation of public policy. They get a little bit tricky, but still you have a statute here that is the personal records law that gives people a right to file rebuttals and to put things in their personal records. And to me, I think it's pretty clear that they shouldn't suffer an adverse employment action because of doing that. And that's exactly the issue that is going to be in front of the court is, can employees put things in their personnel record and suffer an adverse employment action for doing that, or is that unlawful? So it'll just be interesting to see how much teeth the personnel records law really has. And it's another opportunity for the SJC to look at these wrongful termination and violation of public policy claims and see how narrowly they're going to be interpreted or if we're going to expand them to protect employees in the workplace.
I just wanted to jump in on that, this last case, Meehan, because it is going to be before the SJC. And, you know, what I think is really interesting about it from both the plaintiff's counsel perspective and management counsel perspective is that for many of us, requesting the personnel record is kind of the first step to evaluating whether there's a discrimination claim or wage and hour claim, because personnel records are supposed to maintain all of those records, right? They're supposed to maintain anything that's the basis of a potential adverse action. They're supposed to maintain pay records. And so I think it's going to be very interesting to see how the SJC kind of understands and construes the personal record statute in light of the way that it's utilized, from a policy perspective. And also, to the extent that there is going to be a decision that may narrow rights, I am curious about whether we will see the sort of request for the personnel record to be as being maybe even part of a broader discrimination claim, right? Maybe using that as an excuse, it may not be considered pretext evidence if you are, you're terminated on the basis of trying to respond to something that's adverse in your personnel record. And so we may see some of those facts now be part of a discrimination claim until this issue is kind of resolved by the SJC. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really interesting one to keep an eye on. So I think that's really largely what's been happening.